Hi there, and welcome back to the Energy Sector Heroes podcast. My name is Michelle Fraser, and every week I will speak with incredible people who share their lessons, experiences, and stories from their time spent in the energy sector. Hi there, and welcome back again to this week's episode. If you're new to the show, then please take a second to subscribe and even consider sharing the show with just one other person. This week I'm joined by Dane Grubensveld. Dane has over 15 years recruitment and talent management experience, and is also a fellow podcaster of an amazing podcast, actually, The Future of Teamwork. Going to be exciting. It's the exciting topic of discussion. Dane, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Thanks for having me on the show. It's interesting talking to you beforehand that we've got a lot of shared experience working in the oil and gas industry, energy industry, particularly around some of the bigger projects. I know you were mentioning LNG. I grew up in Australia, spent some time in England, and probably the highlight of my career, what really got me launching into this market, was supporting large-scale LNG project developments that we were staffing all over the world. So, you know, the fabrication yards, going into some of the original equipment manufacturers, going out to the actual construction site, and getting to work with just wonderful people, you know, in all corners.
I've worked on two LNG projects, two, three LNG projects. And they were really exciting on site, commissioning, construction. They were probably, a bit of design as well. But they were some of my favorite projects to work on, actually. Yeah. Exciting being on site. Yes, it is. So your podcast, Teamwork. What are the pitfalls in teamwork then? Why do so many leaders get it wrong?
It's funny, right? That's why we started the podcast, because actually going back to some of those LNG projects, I worked on the Papua New Guinea LNG project from a very early stage, and I saw some leaders do great work on that project, you know, bringing teams from all over the world together, getting the culture right, doing the learning right, keeping the emphasis on safety. And when you see a team work well, and then to your point, you see a team fall into the pitfalls of, you know, not being clear on rules and standards, and not spending time to get to know each other and work on your communication and conversation, and it goes wrong, it's night and day. Like, everything, that you go from high energy to low energy, you go from hitting quality, hitting schedule, hitting budget, to everything's on fire. So I think the reason for the gap from, and I'm a student of it, I'm not a scientist, but I think the reason for the gap is the leaders are too busy. I don't think they're making enough time and space to really be working with their teams and finding ways for their teams to flourish in the context of the job.
Okay. So is it really just as simple as for the team leaders to spend more time with their team?
Well, no, it's not simple, but I think if you have to boil it down to one thing, that's the right place to start. Like, just stop. You know, we get busy in large project environments, in large operating environments, just chasing the rhythm and the routine of the work. But if you just stop for a minute, like, grab a few of your team, go and listen to what they're hearing, and start building a plan. That's where you start. Like, you can't just sit in a room and come up with a plan to fix problems. You can't pay a consultant to come in and, you know, fix problems. You have to just stop and spend time with your team. And if you do that well, I think you now turn the problem solving into a team effort. And that's good, because let's be honest, in a project, you've got so many talented people there on the job, and so many of them have different perspectives than what leadership has sitting in their office or in their truck looking at documents or on their laptop. So you want to encourage the exploration of viewpoints, of differences of opinion, and create a little bit more accountability in the team towards, hey, here are our goals. How are we going to solve them? I'm not going to tell you how to do the job. I don't have all the knowledge. Let's agree as a team on our ways of working, on our ways of improving the situation incrementally.
Okay. But how do you go about managing a team? Because of like consultants, because some of the consultants are very, very, very clever people.
Very clever.
And they have their own agenda. They may be, maybe not their own agenda. They might have been taken on to maybe do a specific thing. And sometimes some of them are taken on and they just turn up and they don't even know what they're meant to be doing. I have heard a lot of consultants are hired under that premises.
I see it all the time.
That must be really hard to manage, though, if they just arrive and then you've got to find something for them to do just because you think that they need them.
Yeah. That's a good call. I think a lot of leaders, they rush to hire. Oh, we need an expert in process engineering for the LNG train, or we need an expert in control systems automation. But they haven't really thought about what they really need. They're thinking about the talent they may need on the team, but they're not really thinking sometimes about, well, what's the first task they're going to have to do? Who are the interfaces that they're going to interact with in that team, and how do I, you know, onboard them and get them up to speed? You know, we're often so busy, again, just pulling the team together and getting going, that actually just stopping to take a little bit of time, to your point, to determine what the onboarding process is going to be, to do a little bit of team building. That Papua New Guinea LNG project that I supported, I thought they did a brilliant job of bringing teams together and doing a bit of orientation and team building, you know, at each stage of the project. So I think some of those approaches for leaders help, you know, create some accountability and create some structure for the team to be able to work better together.
Okay. But then, because a lot of companies that do take a long time to maybe onboard some people, a lot of people that do, and then sometimes when you get there, it might be just, still is disorganized.
You're right. Yeah, tell me a bit more about that. So have you personally had an experience, or have you seen a challenge of, hey, we went through a long onboarding process, but we still got here and we don't know who to talk to or where the info is?
I've not experienced that myself, but I know quite a few of my consultant friends who have had that. Sometimes they might hear about a job, they might have got accepted for a job, but then the onboarding takes about 3 to 4 months, sometimes 6 months.
Yeah.
And then they get there and it's still none the wiser.
It's a great point. And I've seen that on a lot of the international projects I've supported over the years. It might be an immigration issue. It might be a background check because they used to work in Nigeria or somewhere where it's hard to get information. So sometimes the onboarding can be stretched out and delayed, or it might just be the phasing of the project. But once you really get in there, particularly if you're a consultant, if you're not an employee, I think a consultant's job is in part to get in there and work out the landscape, have tough conversations. I think a lot of it comes down to conversation. You're in a project environment or operating environment. You've been brought in for a specialized skill set. You know, just like I said earlier, the leader needs to stop and take some time. I think the consultant should also stop and say, well, you've got all this work that could be done. Why do you want it done? When do you need it done by? Who am I working with? I think getting curious is a really good way to identify what people's stories are and what people's needs are. Because otherwise, if you just sit around and complain that your laptop's not ready or you don't have access to this design package, you're only creating noise and frustration for everyone around you.
Yeah, I know. And I appreciate that you're going to have to do a lot of, you know, finding information out for yourself when you first start a job. But still, you can still have a lot of problems with team dynamics as well.
Yeah, and meetings are a big reason for it. Like, you can overdo it on meetings when you turn up on a new job or a project and you don't feel like you've been given much time to read and to go and have, you know, one-on-one conversations with colleagues. You're just being thrown into meetings with the engineers, with the equipment manufacturers, you know, with the site construction contractors. That can actually be a real bottleneck too for teams and for individuals.
Do you think working at home has, because a lot of contractors work from home now, do you think that has helped, or do you think it hinders it?
I'm a little bit old school on that point. I think it's both. But if I'm honest, I think the problem with being remote is that, you know, using Zoom is great, but you don't really make that same level of human connection that is often important in a project or an operating environment. So I think that you get a bit of a drop in fidelity and opportunity there. I think the upsides are there too. You know, you're able to get on with your work undistracted. You're not spending a lot of time traveling to and from site, which a lot of professionals in this industry need to do. So I think you need to blend the both. I think hybrid's better than 100% one way or the other, if I'm honest.
Okay. So if you were recruiting, because I know that you've helped a lot of employment agencies recruit and retain talent. If you were recruiting for someone, what do you generally look for when you're interviewing somebody?
Yeah. I actually start with the job and the project or the role, because if you get a sense of the environment that person's going into, you can probably get ahead of some of those problems that you raised, Michelle. You know the team they're coming into, how long's left in the project, what the rotation or travel requirements might be, maybe what technology or which contractors are on the job. So I think if you start with that and then you go out looking for the right candidate, you've got more information, and therefore you can start to test the candidate's interest in the job, you know, with the full information, because a lot of candidates in this market are highly sought after. We've got a big talent shortage still in pockets, not for everyone. So you want to give them complete information. And if you're able to give them complete information about the job, the role, and you start to ask some questions around, how do you feel about this rotation? Or have you worked with this technology process before? You know, you're going to start to get a little bit more clarity on their ability to fit into that project technically, but also from a human level. You know, are they excited about it? Do they know people on the project? It's an industry where quite often we're working on projects with people we've been on the other side of the desk or the same side of the desk on in the past. So I try and look for that connectivity of willingness, enthusiasm, excitement for the project on top of like the technical skills.
Okay. So are you quite a big fan of the technical interview then?
Technical interview, I leave that to the end customer. Like, I'm not an engineer. I think there is a role for the technical interview, but less and less so as time goes on. I think it's more about behavior and approach. You know, if we run into this problem, we're on site and the documentation isn't there, or there's a piece of equipment that's not in the yard to be deployed that day, how do you troubleshoot? How do you solve that problem? Who do you go and talk to? I like more that behavioral questioning personally, because knowledge is fast changing, and also knowledge is more available now in this digital age. So just knowing what someone's knowledge is doesn't really explain how they're going to show up on the job and how they're going to build that connection and, you know, start to problem solve.
Because I think if you're, especially if you're hiring a contractor, it should be a given that they know if they've contracted for quite a long time.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
It should be.
Yeah.
It's not always a given though. Like I've put people into projects before, and maybe they've embellished a little bit on their resume that they were doing this on the job where they hadn't in fact done that on the job. Maybe their job title on a previous job looks like the job title they're applying for, but the role was different. I once hired a site engineer, and when I really got into it, he had 5 years of site engineering experience, but he was really a contracts administrator. He wasn't doing any engineering,
okay. But
the country and the project he was working in, he had the engineer title, but he was a contracts administrator. So some of the bullet points on the resume didn't line up with the actual duties of the job and the specialty skills that he bought.
Okay. That brings me to a really interesting question, actually, because I only have one CV. I have a website as well, actually,
yeah,
that coincides with my CV. But if you were going to have, if you were applying for multiple jobs, would you have to have different CVs for different jobs you were applying for?
Yeah, it's a good question. In theory, no, you shouldn't. But that site engineer contracts administrator example is a good one, right? You might go to an ExxonMobil project and they call someone an interface manager, an interface engineer. And then you go to a shell project and they call them a project engineer or a project manager. So sometimes language does matter. And there are so many resumes going out there. AI is actually only confusing things in my mind. So I think your ideal scenario is you've got one complete resume. But in the industry, we've always helped coach candidates to say, you're applying to this organization, to this project, and it's important that you highlight these elements of your jobs, or that you put a title on your resume that says what you did, not what you were called, because sometimes they're different. I mean, we're terrible in this, in all industries, not just energy. We're terrible at truly tying out job titles and job duties. Often, you know, a job description is something we pull off the shelf and just throw it there, and then we adapt and we change what we actually end up hiring or asking someone to do.
Okay. So how long should your CV be?
Depends what part of the country you're in. If you're in Australia or the UK, you can have 5-6 page CVs. If you're applying for a job in the US, you really don't want more than 2 pages, because the culture here is very different. And I think regardless of how long it is, I think all job seekers in today's age should be really looking at the first page of their resume, their CV, because if you get the first page right, that's generally where people stop scrolling. Sadly, there's a lot of noise in the recruiting cycle. So you want to make sure you're getting the keywords there, so you're coming up on the AI-driven matches or code-based searches that some of these talent organizations are looking at. And you really want to make sure that first job or second job is on the first page. I don't think qualifications are as critical now as they were 20 years ago. So you really want to talk about the jobs that you're on, the size of the project, your role, perhaps your budget that you're responsible for, but you want to pack that first page in my eyes.
Okay. That's interesting, because I haven't got on my CV, and maybe it's same for a lot of other people, but I haven't got on my CV the budgets that I've managed. I didn't think it would be important. It probably would be important in hindsight, actually.
I think a lot of managers look for that type of thing, because as humans, we look for patterns and we look to simplify things when we're busy and stressed, right? So if I jump into someone's resume and it just says a company name and it doesn't tell me the project that they were on or the phase of the project that they were supporting, okay, or the budget, then I'm guessing what they're on. But if I know that I'm running a, you know, $150 million upgrade project on this type of technology, and here's someone who's coming in with the project manager title and they've run projects in the $80 million to $200 million range around similar technologies, similar operating environments, I see a match. My eye's naturally drawn to those extra data points.
Okay. Interesting. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you get into recruitment then? Is it something that you've always wanted to do?
No, I don't think many of us did. I fell into it in a bar in London, of all places.
No way. I met
a guy who was recruiting in the insurance industry, and I was serving behind the bar, and I asked him what he did. And after a conversation, he offered me a summer job, and I learned what recruiting was, putting floppy disks into a computer and calling down phone lists to find candidates back in the day when not many people had cell phones, mobile phones.
Okay. So finding candidates, is it easier now than it was about 20 years ago?
Great question. I think most hiring managers and recruiters will tell you now it's easy to find a candidate digitally, but it is really hard to engage with them. So I actually think that we've created a lot of noise with all of the technology that we now rely on. And I think that's why there's a big role for recruiting and staffing agencies, because they tend to maintain relationships with candidates and they know who to put forward in pretty quick time. Sadly, that means the experience for a lot of recruiters and for a lot of candidates is fairly inefficient. It can take a lot of time. So I guess in summary on all of that, the key thing is if you want to be finding good candidates for a job, or if you want to be found for a job, if you're a candidate on the flip side, the key thing is to spend a lot of your time in one or two places, make sure that you're known in those places, and don't spread yourself too thin, because there are so many channels out there that you just get lost in sort of the noise. So pick your favorite job board, pick your favorite, you know, media channel where you're going to be putting news out there about your project, and try and create some connectivity in the community where you're either looking for a job or looking for a candidate.
Okay, because I know that a lot of people, when they're looking at when they're looking for a job, they might go to several different, maybe 3-4 different sites. So is that not advisable?
Yeah, I don't think it really works. You know, invariably, staffing companies and hiring organizations will scan most sites, but you tend to find the same person across all four sites. Because if I've gone to Oil and Gas Job Search and Rig Zone and Indeed or Seek or Monster or whatever I've gone to, so much of that scraping process is now getting automated in our technology behind the scene. So I think spend less time in and around the job boards and spend more time networking. Find the recruiter that specializes in that discipline, in that market, or find the key candidates in a market, because there's so much more like word of mouth referral. If you're really out looking for someone, like I could say, hey, Michelle, tell me about who you had a good experience working with in this role on your last job. That's a more efficient way to get engagement than to find their resume and then realize they don't respond to the email, they won't pick up the phone call, maybe the data's not even accurate anymore. So I think that's a big part of the challenge.
Okay. So do you think applying for jobs on your preferred jobs board is still efficient, or do you really have to be, you know, keeping contact with your agencies and your previous contacts?
I think it helps. It depends where you're at in your career. So if you're a contractor or a consultant, mid to late career, you're very talented, you can probably get a little bit more traction applying for jobs when they come through. That would make sense. But if you're early career and you're looking for a full-time job, it's a pretty thankless task applying for lots of jobs and either hearing nothing back or getting emails saying, no, not at this time. So I would say put your resume in those resume databases. Use LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn is a really good place to be sharing your story. And I say story intentionally, like tell the story, hey, I lost my job last month because this project came to a completion, or there was a layoff, or I moved city or town because I just got married and I'm looking for a new job in this space. But tell a bit of a story and see who in your network's going to connect you with the right people. That's probably a better approach for earlier career job seekers.
Okay. Because So is there still a lot of recruiters not getting back to candidates then?
Oh yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible, but it's not the recruiter's fault often. It's the process, it's the systems, because we've used too much technology. We've moved away from relationships. So now if I'm a recruiter, whether I'm working for a large company as a corporate recruiter in-house or an agency recruiter, I don't have a relationship with the hiring manager, and I'm submitting the resume digitally by email or in a system, and I'm hoping I get feedback from someone who's very busy. So often the recruiter's stuck in the middle. They're chasing the hiring manager, or worse, they're having to chase an intermediary who's supporting the hiring manager for feedback from the hiring manager to give to the candidate. So you see the quality of information and the timeliness of information really stretch out. And so I would hazard a guess that for every 10 jobs that are on a job site or a job board, only one or two of them are really good jobs where there is a clearly defined need, there's an urgency and a level of respect in the process design for how are we going to capture a resume, interview a candidate, put them forward, get feedback, you know, make an offer or not. It's a big churn cycle.
Okay. Because I always thought that, because you must have to do, there must be hundreds upon hundreds of people apply for these jobs all the time, though.
Yeah, there are. And sadly, a lot of them, if their resume is not quite right, they just get missed.
Okay. Say with your, as in a competitive type of question, how many people would you typically see applying for one job as maybe an engineer?
If it's a really tight labor category, you might only see one or two people apply that are available and interested. So if it's a really tightly defined role in instrument controls or something like that, you just may not get many active job seekers applying, and you have to go and call people. If it's a broader job, you know, a site engineer, a contracts administrator, particularly a job where the title looks the same in lots of other industries, you might have 300 or 400 applications, and you're not going to look at 300 or 400 resumes. So you use, often businesses will use the AI tools or the algorithms within their databases to, you know, filter to the top who has the most keyword search matches, who should I call? And so you'll go through maybe 5 or 10% of that group of candidates. There are some other processes out there that are far more hands-on. There are some companies that use offshore processing centers to do screening calls. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's not a very high proportion of jobs that you fill from an active job seeker, you know, pressing apply on a job. It's probably less than 25%.
Okay. So how do a lot of companies recruit then? Because they must take somebody that they know then over someone that they wouldn't.
Well, on the big projects for later career people, I would say 7 or 8 times out of 10, they hire someone who's either worked for one of their projects before or has worked with one of their team members on another project. It's a high proportion. And therein lies the challenge, is that we're not really giving the early career folks an opportunity to get in and build experience and learn on these projects. Or if you've well networked, you're more likely to get on the next job than your colleague who's maybe a better engineer than you and really is head down in their work, but doesn't spend as much time, you know, talking to folks at lunch break or out at the bar at the happy hour.
Okay. So I was going to go back to saying, how does a manager deal with, you know, the competitive nature between the engineers on a team?
Oof, that's tricky. There's a lot of personalities in there. There's no silver bullet. I think depending on how big your team is and where your people are and what their disciplines and styles are, you need to be very intentional to come in and set some ways of working, I think is really important. Like, this is how we're going to show up to meetings. This is how we're going to communicate around conflict. You really have to spend a lot more time working on how you work than the work that you do when you've got a team that's suffering a little bit of dysfunction or tension or confusion. So I would say the manager's job is to go in there and just set some of those ground rules and talk openly about what's not working. Sometimes leaders don't want to be vulnerable and go, and they want to just drive tasks. Hey, this is late. The quality on this is poor. Redo it. But actually, sometimes we shouldn't be talking about the work. We should be talking about what's going on in the team. Hey, what am I not seeing here, guys? What's holding you up from being able to do a good job on this scope this week? I think getting curious with those questions is a superpower for leaders who really want to support their teams to do their best work.
I agree, actually. So if you were going to want to improve yourself as a team leader, what kind of skills would you typically need to improve on?
Well, it's a good question. That communication is huge. I think showing that you communicate clearly and often with your team members. I think giving feedback is a separate form of communication that deserves its own bucket, because if you're not giving feedback to your team members and to your managers and to your colleagues, then as a team leader, how are you really serving your team and the organization? So communication, feedback. If I had to pick a third one, I think the best team leaders are always learning, and they make learning a core part of the job. Even if you're a contractor or a consultant that's been bought in, the best team leaders aren't saying, hey, Michelle, just get this done. It's what you're excellent at. That's all I want from you today. They're sitting down with you and saying, hey, Michelle, I know we're doing all of this, but what can you teach me about what you're seeing here on this job or in this process? What would you do differently if we had an opportunity? What could I do to help move an obstacle out of your way? Just that type of learning is really big. So good team leaders will communicate, they'll provide feedback, and they'll be curious and drive learning in their teams.
Okay. But communication, I mean, it is just that you would obviously think it was the simplest thing.
You would.
But many people find it really difficult.
It's, well, there's actually a statistic out there, particularly around communication and feedback, that says, I think 83% of us as humans are afraid that if we tell someone something, they'll take it the wrong way. 83%. So just imagine how much, you know, loss we have in our teams because we're afraid of saying something that we see.
Yeah, but surely if you're in the position of a manager, senior management, you would have to, that onus is on you to deliver maybe bad news if it is bad news.
It doesn't mean they do it well. Have you ever had a boss, Michelle, who's come in there and maybe been too direct in saying what they see? You know, they say it in a mean way, in a short way. You get a text message. I can't believe this isn't the way that I asked for it. Like, they're communicating, but they're not communicating well.
I've not had that. But I'm putting it down to maybe that I was a female and that they may be gentler on me than what maybe some of the other engineers have been. Because I think some managers would be, because if you're managing males over managing females, you would take a different approach. I would think that maybe they don't.
You shouldn't, but sadly it's true. And sometimes actually some managers will lower their communication and feedback because they're uncomfortable about giving the feedback to a female team member. But let's just turn that on its head for a minute. If you're a leader and you're afraid of having a certain conversation with a female team member, you're letting them down. Like that female team member is not getting feedback that they need to keep growing. So you're actually going to be giving feedback to your male team members that helps them learn and grow because you're comfortable with it. And you're uncomfortable giving the feedback to the female team member. And so you're kind of making them get stuck because now they don't get the opportunity to learn how you really wanted it or how to communicate better with Barry over here. So I actually think it's damaging if leaders treat team members differently. It's normal. It's natural, sadly. But that's actually a good sign. Maybe one point on that is on my podcast, I've interviewed a number of people recently who say, if you're a leader and you're looking to drive better team effectiveness, how often do you audit yourself? And what I mean by that is if I've got Michelle and five other engineers, if I just do a very simple audit and I say, okay, of my team of six, how many of them have come to me with a problem in the last 60 days? How many of them have actually said, hey, Dane, this is an issue. Can you help me solve it? And if my answer is, one, Bob, who I love to go out to lunch with, and none of the other five, I've got a problem because Bob's not the only one seeing issues. Everyone else is. Bob just feels more comfortable telling me because I go and watch the football with him. So I think doing some audits as a leader, or if you're a leader of many leaders, doing audits of your leaders, just asking them the question, how many people have brought problematic feedback or concerns to you? That could be a way to start identifying and coaching around those problems.
Interesting. I've got a really good question, actually. If you were a manager and you were maybe a senior manager, and then you would have to manage maybe junior personnel, you might have like maybe about 15 to 20 year age gap between that. How do you even deal with that? Because some of the young ones, although I love working with them, some of them can be quite demanding.
Very, yeah. It's funny you ask that, Michelle. I think it's a great question. It's been a big problem for the last few years, particularly in project environments. But here's what I'm seeing. I think in 2024, the generational noise is going to disappear. We're going to stop complaining about Gen X and Gen Z. And Gen X, Y, and Z. I guess Gen X are the leaders in many cases now. But with those Gen Zers in particular, some of them will say, oh, they're demanding or this, that, and the other. But they're actually very, very capable and very well trained in working digitally because they've grown up with devices, right? Mm. So the way I flip it on its head is, and I'm learning this, by the way, I'm new to it. I'm not a scientist or a professor, is ask them questions. You know, if you've got someone who's 15 years younger than you on the team and who's very tech savvy or communicates in a different way, it might not have anything to do with the technology. Ask them, you know, hey, so-and-so, what do you see here that we could do differently? What bothers you? What don't you understand? Now, that doesn't mean you do everything that they're asking, because some of what they're asking for doesn't work in the context of the team or the project. But it may give you an opportunity to solve a learning gap, an understanding gap. Well, the reason we do it this way is that if that documentation isn't on paper, and if it doesn't get validated by so-and-so over here, and if it doesn't get stored here, then we lose the control, and we lose the opportunity for team members to put their hand up if something's missing. So yeah, we can't automate that with a piece of AI. We're going to continue bringing the document to people for signature and conversation. So that there may be examples of that, but just asking for what they see is going to get you 50% there in building the right relationship, because they're going to feel heard and they're going to feel like you're trying to work with them, rather than just telling them, hey, it wasn't like that in my day. Just put your head down and do it this way. That's not going to work for anyone.
No, I wouldn't have thought so as well.
Hmm.
What is the worst thing about working in recruitment then?
Oh, it's a cowboy industry. So sadly, recruiting is a messy process, like we talked about earlier. And so that means that different people have different levels of information. They've got different access to relationships. They've got different understandings of what needs to happen and, you know, timeframes in which to get that done by. So there's a lot of people that are just racing around trying to connect the right person and the right job and, you know, get paid if you win, or get a tap on the shoulder from your boss if you make a good hire, if you're an internal recruiter versus an agency recruiter. So with that comes some, you know, poor practices. And I think as a recruiter, you feel really bad if you can't deliver for a customer because a candidate had five jobs that they were talking to people about and didn't tell you. And right when you got to offer stage, they were like, oh, thanks, but I'm taking this other job. And you're like, well, hey, Jimmy, you never told me you were applying for other jobs. So that can be a problem. You can have other problems where you've got a candidate that really needs to make a decision. They really need to get back to work or to find this next job. And you haven't got any feedback from the customer. And if you're just telling them, hey, I'm sorry, the customer just hasn't told me if they like you or not, that's no fun either. You're the messenger with bad news in some respects. And then on top of all of that, I would say a lot of recruiters out there are behaving badly in today's digital age, and they're sending resumes of candidates that they haven't even spoken to, and they're just waiting until a customer comes back and says, can I have an interview? And then they try and engage them. So that creates agitation on both sides, and it makes people feel like the recruiter isn't doing a good job in general, even though you might be doing a good process, you know, one of your competitors might not. So I would say kind of the confusion and messiness of the process is the hardest part of the job for recruiters to navigate.
I mean, I knew that a lot of the recruiters, they would send out your CV without even telling you. I knew that went on.
Which is terrible.
Which has been going on for a while, a long, long, long time. Even when I was young, and I'm not so young now, it's been going on for a while. But one of the new things...
Breaks down trust.
Yeah. But one of the new things I've seen is exclusivity letters.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's the right way to do it. And it doesn't have to be exclusivity. It could be a right of representation. Hey, Michelle, are you okay for me to represent you to Total for this job? That's fair. I think a recruiter asking you as a candidate to say you're only going to be represented by Dane, unless they've got access to all the best jobs in the market, why would you reduce your chances of being introduced to the right people? So you got to look at, you know, what they're asking for in those letters.
Okay. So are you quite a big fan of them then? Do you think it's the right way to go about, especially if someone's really quite senior?
I think they're a fantastic approach. And don't get me wrong, exclusivity can work. If you're a very senior individual and you want one person to manage your brand, because remember, if you're the candidate, if you, Michelle, are saying, I'd like to get an understanding of what jobs are out there for me in 2024 in this market, then you don't want five people representing you in different ways. You want someone who really gets your story and message right and gives you the best chance. So I think they're a great idea. I think there's a lot of professional courtesy that comes with operating in that way.
Okay. So do you have any advice to any budding graduate wanting to get into recruitment, HR? What would your advice be?
Yeah, I think I don't really separate by job or discipline. Like if you're a graduate, you've got a lot in front of you. Now, obviously, some jobs need technical skills. So in HR and recruitment, if you want to get into that industry, I would just go out and meet people, virtual cups of coffee. Who do you know through your family network or your church or your football club that might work in the industry? Go and ask them, you know, what's a day in the life like? What do you like? What do you dislike? What would you do differently? Where would you go if you were me? Just go get curious, build network. I think that's probably the first thing I would do. And there's a huge value. Like I think the energy sector is a wonderful place to work. I think it's full of wonderful people. There's huge value in being attached to large facilities and organizations that have managed these facilities, either building or operating them, because you get to work in this global community of talent. You're working with great technology, challenging, you know, operating environments around safety and environment. You just get to touch so many different things. You don't get pigeonholed too early in your career. And so you get to learn through just association with, you know, the technical complexities, the social complexities. And if you're a graduate, what better thing can you invest in than learning, you know, how the world works? And I think the energy sector really creates that opportunity for a lot of people.
Okay. I think I'm going to wrap up things there. I was going to ask everybody the same question. If you could turn back time, would you change anything?
Great question. Do you want me to answer that?
Yeah, please go on.
If I could turn back time, would I change anything? You know, if there was one thing I would have done, which my dad was recommending that I do at the time, I probably would have, you know, before wife and children, like to have spent a bit more time actually on site. You know, I visited sites a lot, but I never worked on site. I never worked in a rotating, you know, project or role. I think it would have been great to actually be on site, live on site, work on site for, you know, just whether it was 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. That's a bit of experience that I don't have in my locker.
Okay. Excellent. I do wholly support that answer, actually, because I think working on site, I say it all the time to all young budding, even if you're an engineer or whatever you're going to be doing, you should get yourself on site, offshore, whatever it is your project is. It is important. Yep. Okay. That's all the questions I have for today. I would like to thank Dean for your time. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening and see you next week. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, I'd like to gently encourage you to leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with another person. You can also follow me on LinkedIn or via my website, www.michellefraserconsultancy.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week.